original.
Yes.
So that this is the early.
Yes.
Business.
Yes.
Up to the outbreak of war, you see.
Yes.
10 years about. And who the honorary officers should be. President, honorary secretary, honorary. Wait a moment, I'll finish reading, sir.
Mm-hmm.
You better please yourself on your
desk. I'll send you a copy of it.
You
and then.
It.
No, I quite understand.
Because when I came over here, with a wide degree of experience, which a sort of experience that most of the women I met here then hadn't begun to have. They have more now. Not only through this. I remember going to a party where some of the leading women workers, like Eleanor Rathbone, did you ever hear of her?
Oh, yes.
Yes, when all her group. And she was a non-militant, of course. She was mostly interested in children and all that sort of thing. And do you know Eva Hubbock?
Oh, yes, very well.
Do you know her?
I've spoken to her children, who are...
Is she still alive?
Oh, no, she died in 1950.
Mm.
She was a remarkable woman, I think.
She was very much interested in citizen education as a whole. Wasn't she the principal of Morley College?
That's right.
I hadn't much to do with her.
Mm.
At one point in my own career, I then came into touch with her a bit.
Mm.
Well, anyway...
you met all these women from the National Union, and you feel they didn't have the experience you had.
Well, I went to groups and listened, and I was invited to special parties where I was supposed to be a special guest. They hadn't the dimmest idea, most of them. You see, they'd been fighting a suffrage struggle about which I know very little. Very little indeed. I do know there was a bill, was it in 1928, which gave
the vote
to women over 30.
No, 1918 was over 30, and 1928 was
the full vote.
Yes.
Of course,
yes.
That 1918 business was ridiculous.
Mm.
Because lots of women wouldn't admit that they were over 30 anyway.
That's right.
Well, that's natural enough.
Yes.
It may seem funny to you, but it's not funny in a competitive world, you know.
Yes.
And in any case, women then hadn't the sort of freedom that they have now at all.
Mm. Mm.
But it's not for me to judge that world because I didn't live in it ever.
But you feel, coming from Australia, you had a different range of experience, did you?
Not only felt it, it's a fact.
Mm.
That the women who come from Australia have a different outlook, but when they come to London, we hope to get them and lead them towards a better conception of political interests. There are many political-minded women in Australia,
mm.
but they don't combine very much as far as I know. I don't now know them well at all.
Mm.
There's no reason why I should criticise them. Didn't you find most of them were rather elderly then?
Yes, they were.
Of course, Ruby
yes.
Richard is very well known.
Yes.
But she's, I don't know how old now, I haven't heard from her for a long time.
So when you, just to recap, you took a history degree in Sydney with the highest honours.
Mm, first class honours.
Yes, you then...
And a leaving scholarship.
Mm.
But this leaving scholarship was so pitiably small that year after year nobody would take it. I mean, we took it because... was given I think it was called the Fraser Scholarship.
Oh, yes, yes.
But you couldn't do anything with it. It was, I don't know what it was, £85 a year or something or other.
So then you took a WEA lectureship.
Yes, under Meredith Atkinson.
Yes.
Went around organising groups.
In Australia, that
in
was.
In Australia, mm. on the coastline round Sydney. Don't talk about Australia.
Mm.
About New South Wales only.
Yes.
Well, then, I went to the United States... partly because I wanted to travel, really, and also because we could not get track of my elder brother. He was younger than I, but he was the third member of our family. And
your other brother had been killed by that time, had he?
He was killed.
Hmm.
And I used to tour with the then Premier of New South Wales, a man named, I've forgotten his name now, Norman, I think it was. And we used to address large groups of men who didn't want conscription. They were always very decent to me, I must say.
You were in favour of conscription, were you
yes,
then?
Yes, I could see no other way out.
Yes, yes.
And the Premier was in favour of them too.
Yes.
And then, I must cut out the irrelevant detail. When you're older, your mind is apt to turn back on it.
All this is useful to me, so shall I cut out what I
Well,
think?
I don't care about what you cut out, it's what I choose to cut out. You see? I'm apt to think of so many things that really would have no concern with your particular book. But they do concern me and my private life very, very deeply. Anyway, my friend was just died here, and I came over here.
She was also an Australian, was she?
Well, she was born and brought up in Australia, but she belonged to the group, the family group. She was a descendant of those people, some of those people, who went out there in early days to sort of, you know, there was a handful of convicts who were sent out. There were none sent to South Australia. Where they were, and gradually the church began to feel its responsibility, and judges went out, and magistrates and so forth, and the family of Scott, to which she belonged, Miss Rose Scott, was a very...
Oh yes, they were prominent feminists, weren't they, the Scots?
Rose Scott, in Australia, was a very well-known feminist of the old school, but a charming woman with not militant in that sense. But if you go into the life of Rose Scott, you wander far afield and you have to go to other people.
I
know that upstairs I have papers they haven't yet sorted to belong to that part of history, but I know nothing about them.
Your friend was called Scott, was she?
Her name was Mary Scott Shaw before she married. And then it was Mary Scott Minkin, and she was the niece of Miss Rose Scott.
I see, yes.
And Miss Rose Scott has always hated me then, because she came away with me. I didn't ask her to, but she wanted to come. She wanted to break away from the circle of people who in those days, you know, would always pounce on the unmarried woman to do all the little jobs that need doing. And they never got a life of their own. Different today, of course. Today she was a very good writer. This is quite irrelevant to your...
But you both had a sort of feminist connections in Australia then, I mean...
She was Mrs. Mary Scott Minkin, that is, Mary Scott Shaw, who has just died, had no interest in feminism. She didn't realise, in organised feminism, she didn't realise how deeply at heart she would fight for a woman's right at any time. She didn't join societies and she hated committees. And she was artistic. And there I think we leave her to rest in peace.
But you also came from a family that had a...
No. My father was a clergyman of the Church of England. And my mother went to the United States because some uncle embezzled all her money. She had a lot. He embezzled it some way. And there the two met. My father, who was a refuge from a family of 13 children, most of whom were women, and mostly missionaries. He couldn't stand it. You'll never put that into your book. And he went off to the United States, a high-spirited, rather good-looking young man with a beautiful speaking voice. And he met my mother and they got married. And then it was decided the best course for him was to come back and finish the degree that he'd left unfinished in Cambridge. So at 3 weeks old, I came over here in a basket. And then, later on in history, Bishop Montgomery, the father of Monty.
Oh, yes.
And he was the bishop of the island of Tasmania. He came over here to recruit clergy to go back and travel much of the untouched land in Tasmania. We're thinking in terms of something, you must remember, years ago.
Yes.
Long, long years
ago. Oh,
yes,
yes.
Long before the 1914 war. He came over here and he managed to recruit my father. For the additional reason, my father was then a curate at St. Mary Abbott's here.
Oh, yes.
And one of the chaplains at the court, incidentally. But the youngest child, the boy who was afterwards to be killed fighting for England, was tended to consumption. And the only way to get him a long sea voyage was to go overseas, which he took it. That's how we got there. But there was no desperate, there was no real feminist link there at all.
So anyway,
I was simply out of my own mind and thinking.
So you're both going off to America now.
We went to America.
What happened next?
Well, we stayed in America for a good many years. And during the First World War, a lot of Englishmen were prowling around there. I remember very well indeed, we met an Australian soldier.
Telephone call for Mrs. Muller, room 333. Mrs. Muller to nurse telephone, please.
Wow. What were we talking about then?
You were talking about how you went to America and how there were a lot of English, there were a lot of men prowling around.
Yes,
put it.
But there's a good gap there, of course, of being brought up with my own strong feminist ideas and all sorts of things that I used to do that nobody knew anything about and didn't matter. But there it was. And Montgomery had carted my father and family out there. My mother was a highly educated woman, spoke two or three languages, played the piano. It was literally nothing. He promised my father a living, which used to mean a comfortable house in a little select parish, you know, with the upper class and all the rest. It was literally nothing. 40 square miles of illiterate people.
Yes.
And
how did your mother cope in that situation?
She coped as a magnificent, any magnificent woman of courage and strength would. That's something no man can ever understand, or ever will understand. I remember when a great bushfire came, the rectory was up on the top of a hill. It was a wooden place. She had the two youngest boys there. There was this sheet of flame coming steadily towards her. She wrapped the baby up in wet towels and put him under the bed. I don't know what she did to the other little boy, probably wrapped him up in damp clothes also. Went outside and rang the church bell. A lot of men began to come up with branches to beat the flames back. And just when they thought the whole place, including the little children, would be mopped up by this terrible fire, the snakes running under the culverts and all the rest of it, the wind changed and it was swept the other way. That's the sort of woman my mother was.
A very courageous woman.
Well, you are what you think is a lecturer now. Mm-hmm. What do you want to be when you've finished that?
Well, I think I shall stay what I am, actually. I mean, I'm a fellow of Corpus, you see, so I can stay there for life.
What does fellow
mean? Well, it means that you teach there for life, really, if you want to, which is what I'd like to do, really.
Mm.
But you left both your parents behind then when you left Australia, did you?
Oh, yes, of course.
I see.
They've been married a long time. I'm just considering the kind of people I've known as lecturers at the university and comparing you in my mind with them. All different types, aren't you, now?
Yes.
And anyway, my friend and I eventually, she had no university education, didn't want it. We traveled right across the United States together, saw many interesting things, including the Grand Canyon. Finally settled in New York because at the beginning, you see, of the Second World War, America wasn't in. And then when the time came when she entered, all the young men were called up, all were conscripted, and they were very glad indeed to have educated women there to do some of the jobs.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, I was in the graduate school there, and then, after that, I came over to England.
That's about 1922 or so.
I think it was. I'd have to check
that. Sort of time, anyway.
I'd have to check that.
Mm.
Well, do I remember standing on the steps of Columbia University, which has a wonderful facade, going up to a particular part of the university. I forget which part it was now. Not very important. Talking to a tall Australian soldier returning, a big fine fellow with his feathered hat and all the rest of it, and an Englishman who was a professor somewhere came trotting up. All I know, he was half American. He ignored us completely, my friend and I, spoke to this fellow and said, will you come and talk to me? I'm so interested in your curious accent. And this Australian looked at him gravely. Then he turned to me, lifted his hat as well as he could, I said, may I introduce my friends? I'd met him about 10 minutes beforehand, Miss Collison, and Miss Shaw she was then. With one cold smile, we dismissed the Englishman. Didn't give me a very good idea of Oxford or Cambridge at that time, though my father was a Cambridge man.
Yes, yes.
Well, then, after travelling many adventures in the United States, including a brief spell when we got into the house belonging to a drug addict, that wouldn't interest you either. Then let's see what happened then that's relevant to your subject.
You came over to England?
Yes, I came to England, and I was shocked to find that all the inhabitants that I met, I was asked to give certain lectures on a, I think it was a sort of summer school or something in Oxford. Nobody really knew anything about what was happening overseas fundamentally. They just thought, well, England can rest safely on all these people, and as for the women, well, what were they doing? The women had the suffrage up to a point.
This
was clear. England was overloaded with women, you see, and of course two wars had killed off their prospective husbands, their lovers, their brothers.
This was the National Union of Societies for Equal Citizenship you lectured to, was it?
No. I never lectured to them. I had my own lecture syllabus where I went where I could get my fee.
I see.
What they were, if they wanted to know about what I knew, I gave it to them. And my career is not especially significant at this point. And then I realized what they needed was an awakening of this kind. And Mrs. Rishbeath, I was sitting in the park, not St. James's, what's the name of the other big park? The Green Park.
The Green Park, yes.
Thinking about it, you see, how utterly ignorant these people were, except of the English interest, which was quite, as I see now, looking back from an older wisdom, I see now how natural it was, but to me, coming from younger lands, with fresh interests and another outlook, they were very, very one-sided. And I was sitting in the Green Park thinking, and all of a sudden I saw Mrs. Rishbeath, whom I knew slightly, not very well, but well enough, walking across. And I said, oh, what are you doing here? And she said, well, there are such troubles about the currency that I've got to stay here for a while. There were problems, you know, in this, terrible. You're too young. You weren't born, I don't suppose.
No.
No, well, you wouldn't understand. And I said, well, I'll tell you what I've been thinking about. And I told her. I said, here are all these splendidly educated English women. They have the background behind them, fine universities, magnificent books, a kind of intellectual training that you don't get on the other side of the world always. A few people find it. Not many get it. And they haven't even troubled to look what's there. And the people that I have met who've been through the university colleges don't appear to have it either. They just don't know what they're talking about. And I consider that we should have some form of Commonwealth organization which would begin to point the way to what is being done, because I don't know whether I knew it then, but perhaps I did. Anyway, she and I talked about it, and she said, yes, I understand what you mean. She was a very pretty woman, and she had a lot of money. Her husband had died and left her a fairly wealthy widow. She wasn't what you and I would call really educated, but she was highly intelligent, and in a curious way, she could put her finger on any law or action or act that was likely to affect women. And having the money, she'd hire the most primitive planes of the day and go off to the Federal Parliament in Canberra. She knew what I meant, you see.
So between you, you started
Well, as a matter of fact, I wrote all this stuff, you see. But one thing I will give to the English women, Marjorie Corbett Ashby is one of them. Although even she, I'm very fond of her, but even there is a touch of that. All those leading women, there's a touch of that same, not misunderstanding, but failure to comprehend. She is so much wiser now that I think it's nearly vanished. I think she saw further than most of them. But it's difficult to put your finger on it, just.
Was it failure to comprehend the nature of the women's movement in the Commonwealth? Is that
not that there wasn't a proper women's movement, really. It was here and there and everywhere.
Mm.
But she did comprehend what we were after trying to get, Mrs. Rishbeath and I. Well, Mrs. Rishbeath just faded out of the picture. But then the next thing was, very few people know this. I doubt if even Marjorie Corbett knows it. I'm not at all sure. There was a very rich Yorkshire woman called Sarah Clegg.
Oh, yes, I've
Miss
come across
Sarah it. Clegg. And she had, I believe, though I have not got the facts, that she had inherited two considerable fortunes, at any rate one. I mean, they mightn't look considerable today, but
no, in those days.
She was very independent. And she was a great supporter of the old Lyceum Club for Women, which, of course, you never saw.
Mm.
I forget when it went out of existence, not so many years ago. They had one of the big houses in Piccadilly. And they were quite a centre for women who had that type of interest, you see. But really, Miss Clegg had put a good deal of the financial management of that centre into the hands of someone who mismanaged her money. She began to get impatient about the whole thing. But anyway, she was wealthy, she was old, and she took a great fancy to me. In those days I was quite young and very full of spirit and life, you see. And she financed, eventually, the British Commonwealth League, practically financed it, because the little trickle of subscriptions, 7 and 8 pence, and of a few affiliated societies paying whatever it was, £5 or something, couldn't possibly keep the thing going, you see. And during those years, I flung myself into that league and organized it a great deal. And I mean, anyone will tell you that. And in fact, there was a printed article about it not long ago. So it doesn't matter my telling you. It's not just boasting. It's a fact, you see.
Could I just ask you, were you already a member of the International Woman Suffrage Alliance then?
I don't remember.
I mean, you weren't originally active in that, and
I never heard of the International
Alliance.
I came into that very, very gradually through the then secretary, Mrs. Bumpus.
Oh, yes.
Who was a very intelligent and a very clever woman.
Have
you ever met her?
I haven't met her, but Dame Marjorie's told me about
her.
She's
quite old now.
I think she's dead, actually.
Yes, I shouldn't wonder.
Yes.
But a very interesting woman. But you see, what impressed the newcomer was the number of women with great talents and great interests. And there were so many of them, you see, that the chances for a woman like Mrs. Bumpus were relatively limited, because I don't think she had a university degree. I've really forgotten what they're worth. My view of them as a whole is very different now from what it used to be. And then, you see, from those beginnings, Mrs. Rishbeath and I sat there somewhere, stuck away in my papers, if I haven't burned it up, is the original wording of this very constitution. She wasn't, I wouldn't ever put this into a book, but she was not capable, in terms of literacy, of writing such a thing. But she had all the interest and all the keenness and the ability to pick on the points, you see. And she was a very pretty woman, which is very important.
So between you were a powerful team, really, were you?
Well, you could put it that way if you liked, I suppose. She vanished. I don't know what happened. I suppose she went back to her own country after a bit. And then, until the Second World War made voluntary work almost impossible, you see.
Why was that actually, Ms.
Well,
Constance?
Because any of us who had money, I had no money in those days, not being. But anybody who had was working for the forces, or and if they were not people with money but housewives, they were doing marvellous things with great stores of food parcels and knitted articles and confidence. They were the resting places of the men who were fighting too.
Well, the WVS, I suppose, as well, was a very active organisation,
yes,
wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, all that. I didn't know all that very well. Well, but then the British Commonwealth League, as I knew it, she began in those early days. We had our first conference in 1925. The one I've been reading to was 1929.
Yes.
And they went on pretty successfully until the war broke out. But I'm wondering where the first copies are. I'm afraid I let them have... You know, I didn't realise how big a thing we'd started.
Mm.
Well, now, the work that is chiefly done is that it is... It's an important... And don't put this... This would be very, have to be very carefully handled.
Mm.
It's an important centre. It has no offices and therefore no expensive office upkeep. They do have a secretary, but the secretary doesn't get, you know, nothing like a commensurate salary. She does, I'm not quite sure, entirely voluntary. We'll say expenses, you see.
Mm.
It's run on a very small budget.
Mm.
You'll have to study the budgets for yourself.
Yes.
Because you must remember that as I grow older, a budget of the kind they might present simply seems funny compared to what is needed to live today.
Yes.
So you'll have to balance that up carefully.
Mm.
And then...
But did the Second World War change the nature of the League then? Did it become a different...
Well, it simply lay quiescent, you see. There were meetings. And one of those who was prominent in them was Miss Daisy Solomon. She lives in South Africa now.
Mm.
She's a very interesting woman. Of course, she's old and crippled. She may die any time now. But in South Africa, she belonged to, I don't know if she founded, what was known as the Black Sash movement.
Yes.
Well, you see, what we did, if you read any one of our conferences, we were simply educating. And the societies, we would pick out our list of speakers. Well, now, much of that, you see, the war made available, and the growth in transport and the cheapness of transport. And between ourselves, great anxiety of many of women from places you never heard of before, like Botswana and Guyana and Ghana and those places, you see. They had no vocal point, except that they went to their, meet their own Ghana friends or their own, you see. And now once a month for, not every month in the year, not in November, December or January, but for say 6 months in the year, there's a monthly lunch where they meet and hear speakers who give them all kinds of viewpoints.
Mm.
But how much of that now really leads to political education, I'm not able to say.
Mm.
But it does do something, you see.
Mm.
And if we're going to have a Commonwealth voice in politics, I think it is still important.
Mm. Can you explain to me, Miss Collison, what the relationship became between the Commonwealth League and the International Woman Suffrage Alliance? Did it become a sort of...
No.
Was it related in any way to it?
Those people, any society that wants to affiliate the International Alliance of Women can do so if it agrees with the principles of the British Commonwealth League. Well,
the
British Commonwealth Society could, and a little while ago, an effort, in my view, a mistaken effort, was made. I want you to get one thing clearly into your mind. When I came back, you see, during the war, the government asked me to take a post as what we called a woman power officer. Do you remember the last word?
No, well, I do vaguely, but I don't know what a woman power officer
was.
Well,
you see, it all seems remote from this, but it isn't really. England was divided roughly into 10 areas, I think it was 10. And in each area, years before the war, and added to each year some government department or some foreseeing member of the government organization had arranged that every occupation within that area, and as it was a tenth of English, is easy enough in the large industrial areas, but even the little hairdressers and the little sweet shop people and everybody, they were all listed with the separation of the woman force and the man force and the capabilities, the occupations of women and so on. And of course, even that wasn't a completely reliable guide. Now, I was in Bradford. The government asked me to go to Bradford. I was never more surprised than anything in my life. And how did we get there? They sent round, you know, in the early days of the war, about the men, they could get at them all right, but they got every employer before the war was having to supply a list of how many women he employed and what they were in each area, you see. And the point was that with an instrument like that at your hand, if you were careful, you could organize a flow of labor. You took out an important man and you put the next important one in there instead. And then you were, suppose, for example, you were looking at heavy lorry drivers, which the women power officer didn't do, you would find there was an employer, maybe it was safe to say, for example, had five heavy lorry drivers, more likely he'd had 50, but five will do. And the manpower officer for that district had to have a knowledge of the particular interest, and Bradford was textile. And he would know that two of those men eventually would be called up.
I see.
And then they would have to be filled with the men next to them. And then the women who'd been driving lighter lorries, not
they'd
such
move
a,
up, they'd move sort up. Of thing. Yes,
and gradually they'd move up from the bottom. Mm. That was my job, you see.
So did you do that all through the Second World War?
Well, at first I was in the BBC, and I got so sick of it, because it was a reserved occupation. Mm. I did some broadcasting to Australia. It was a reserved occupation, and young men were running into it out of the universities and all sorts of places. And when they got in, they then managed to wangle their girlfriends in. I never saw so many fur coats and diamonds in my life. And people were literally sitting on steps waiting to be told what job to go to. The BBC had short training courses, which to most of us were, well, they were useful, but not much more. Once you'd done the training course, you were appointed to a job. Well, they were sitting there waiting to be trained, waiting to...
So you didn't really feel happy in that sort of
They were
world.
Happy enough because they were safe, they weren't fit.
Mm.
And it got sorted out afterwards, but of course some of them were well educated in languages and they were very useful.
Mm.
But for the beginning it was a mishmash like so many British things.
Mm.
These lads were getting their girls in to keep them reserved, you see. And so on.
So did you, I mean, at the end of the war, then did you resume your British Commonwealth League
work?
Well,
I didn't particularly, because by that time, here Mrs. Corbett Ashby steps in. She had picked out a woman named Mrs. Hemming.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, Harold Hemming, her husband, has just died. He was an awfully nice man. I've got a very good obituary of him, if you want to see where the connection comes. And I had a note from her, I wrote to her at once. She said he was a kind and gentle man, but he was a very capable man. And I don't know whether she had money of her own or what. But she had at least one car, perhaps two, which very few of us have, you see. And she's very flamboyant and an exhibitionist. And that perhaps is what was needed. I don't know, it's not...
What, she became the president then, did
yes.
she, of the British Commonwealth League? I see.
Mm.
And the executive committee is an enormous committee, the representatives from all affiliated societies, and I still sit on it.
Mm.
But I have been very careful not either to raise my voice over much or to criticise, because in many ways it would have been better perhaps if I'd walked right out, but they didn't want me to do that then. I don't think they do now. We had some very able women. We had a woman called Gloria Davis, did you ever hear of her?
I haven't come across her, no.
Well, I think you should ask her what her experiences were of work with the British Commonwealth League, and she was well ensconced with Mrs. I think Mrs. Hemming chose her, I'm not sure. You see, Mrs. Hemming is a woman, well, she's very flamboyant, but you see, perhaps that was needed.
Yes.
And she seems to have made a good choice. I certainly think you should see Gloria Davis, but to be tactful, you can't see Mrs. Hemming now, I'm sure, not at present.
No.
But
anyway, I mean, your knowledge is more valuable to me because you can go back further.
Oh, yes, further. But she is now one of the leading spirits. And how she will come out of it now that her husband is dead, I have no idea. It depends on what money he left, you see, and so on.
Could I just take you back a moment? I mean, was the British Commonwealth League entirely on its own then, between the wars? I mean, or were you part of the English women's movement in
any way? I would never say that we were part of the English women's movement. I would say it was a separate entity, entity between the wars. And that is my view, you see. And efforts have been made recently to get it to affiliate. We'd like it to affiliate as an associate group. It couldn't be a proper affiliated group because there are too many different conflicting policies, you see.
Yes.
For example, on a problem as delicate as that of prostitution, the views of many Commonwealth members are quite different. Or if you take the vast population of India and its awful problems, misery and dirt, have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
Well, I've only been there for a month, but that was quite enough. I was called away from Delhi, where I was visiting, to go right over to the other side to address a vast meeting, one of the first women's rights meetings there. Now, the women didn't know what they were doing. Most of them wore nose rings, very few clothes, and they really didn't know what it was all about, but they loved a bit of coming together, you see. When I arrived, I had to climb up a tall, rickety bamboo structure like that and address all these rows and rows of women. And in the middle, half of them got up and walked out. I felt pretty mad. I spoke to the organisers and said, "What are you doing making a fool of me, bringing me here to women? I don't want to talk to them." They said, "Oh, they simply don't know what you're talking about. They love coming together." Well, that sort of propaganda has to be done by somebody, you see. I didn't know what I was doing. I'm only giving you a touch of personal experience.
Yes. But you were trained, in a way, as a public speaker, were you, by the WEA, really?
No, I've never been trained by anybody.
I mean, you got your first experience, did you, in speaking?
Well, taking lectures, and long before I took up that work.
Yes.
In the, well, it's really relevant to what you're thinking about, what I am. I'm just one of many. But I have an unusual brain for a woman, that's quite certain. But there are plenty of women in England who also have excellent brains and who have had far more training. I know nothing about music or art, very little, except what I'm picking up as I go along. But I certainly have a good brain, that's quite certain, I know that.
So you were good at drafting things and taking minutes and that sort of thing?
Well, I've been trained for years in university life.
Yes.
And also, I don't know, why should I not be good at them? Not everybody has that particular talent. They have many other talents, you see, which are equally useful.
But could you explain to me what you did in the early years? I mean, your main activity was organising the conference, was it?
Well, I think I'd better fish out the press, a few press notices, let you have a look at them.
Very kind of you.
Because I have no idea of the sort of impact that I made on people. How could I have? As a matter of fact, many people who, like myself, are on the whole far more interested in books and law and custom than they are in people. And this kind of organization needs also people who are interested in people. And Miss Clegg, it was, who took a fancy to me, you see, and financed the league on condition that I would be the secretary. So what could I do but be the secretary for some time until things began to break up? But I didn't do only that. I also used to tour. I've been to Belfast and Dublin, all sorts of places, talking on what, prepare a syllabus. Did you ever hear of the City Literary Institute?
No, I haven't come across that.
Young man, you have much to learn. The City Literary Institute is a great institution in London. And it has an enormous syllabus, and it provides classes on all kinds of things. Just as they call sometimes the overseas club, you know, the Salvation Army of clubs.
Yes, yes.
So the City Literary Institute, here again, you must never put this down.
Yes,
is
yes.
what you might call a sort of a Salvation Army for people who want to learn something.
Yes.
And it has excellent lecturers. There's one man, when I was lecturing there, who used to take... Well, you couldn't... The classrooms couldn't accommodate his classes. They were so large. And it's an excellent foundation for people who have never taken university work to attend many of their courses. You should get one of their syllabuses and have a look at it.
Yes. So...
Well, you see, as far as I went, I went round making work for my the League, building up and speaking for the League, and also doing certain things on my own. I also lectured at the City Literary Institute. I would go down to Belfast, if you like, and talk to the Women's Institutes of Belfast or the mixed big clubs in Belfast. And I remember how hard... Oh, what's that religious movement that's always trying to get people...
Not Seventh-day Adventist.
No. Oh, bother, it's gone out of my head. I'm getting a little bit old.
You've got a very precise memory, if I may say so.
It's not as precise as it might be, because I wasn't interested enough all the time. The memory is pretty fair, but I'm sure I've left big gaps, you see.
But you weren't full-time then as secretary. It was a sort of part-time activity, was it?
What was part-time?
Being secretary of the British Commonwealth League.
Well, I was honorary to begin with.
I see.
And
see.
Then I got a salary later on. But I soon saw there was no real future in it, because what overseas people of the type that you were getting, were beginning to get then, with cheaper transport, travelling in packs or travelling singly, and endless opportunities of scholarships here and scholarships there and so on, for all of which I was really too old, you see, to compete. I then meant for younger people. You're getting those people. They will come, they will pay for a luncheon, or they'll, somebody will bring them and they will join. They have perhaps 40, 50, 60, 80 people, or 100. And if you don't want to eat the full lunch, you can have coffee and a bun or something or other, you
yes.
see. Well, there was no real solid future in that sort of thing for people like myself, you see. And in any case, by that time, they wanted it, and naturally they ought to have had, and they got, a younger woman, you see, younger people. And this woman, Gloria Davis, that I've been talking about, was one of the very best I've ever met.
But your early activity was doing the organisation work behind
yes,
the scenes.
Oh yes, any amount of it, you see. If you read the reports through pretty well, you'll find out
So you had to get speakers, I suppose, did you, and collect subscriptions and organise meetings?
No, we had a treasurer for subscriptions.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yes, of course. Didn't do that sort of thing. But I don't know, these reports tell a little of a sort of thing that has to be done, you see.
So who was your president then, Mrs. Collison?
I think it was Mrs. Corbett Ashby.
Was it really? I see, yes. From 1925 onwards.
I can't remember. I'd have to look and see at the list.
But you worked under a president then, all the way through.
Well, they worked and did what I told them to do, whichever way you like. But Mrs. Ashby, you see, is a person of great tact and quality, even now. And she had the capacity, you see, in this, now 1929, I'm listed as the honorary organizer, which is what I was, but somebody had to find the money. And Miss Clegg would give the money as long as I was there, and she did. But then when I left, you see, it was more difficult.
But you got on very well with Miss Clegg.
And now, you see, the younger people, they want, and they ought, they probably can get someone who can drive a car, who is, agreeable about taking people about and all that sort of thing. I never learned to drive, and I never shall. I was too old, you see. And I had many other concerns in my mind as well, in which I was much interested. I say, what is the time for the...
It's 20 to 6, Miss Carson.
Yes,
don't let me keep you longer
than
you
right.
want to stay.
But I don't see that all this is very helpful.
Now, you're giving me a picture of what the organisation was like. I mean, did it have meetings, small meetings of branches then in England, or...?
They've never formed branches.
I see.
You see, it would depend so much how much money you had, whether you could tempt the right people to go to such places. I went to all sorts of places, and very often I wasn't asked even to speak about the league at all. Sometimes it might be, sometimes not, but you have to remember that England is a mass of organisations. The International Alliance of Women itself was a breakaway. The National Council of Women is a solid stock organisation, and it does quite good work. But now the International Alliance of Women, if you're interested in that, has had to do a great number of seminars, did Mrs. Ashby?
She has told me a bit about that, yes.
Well, then, if you're going to discuss seminars, you better go and see Amy Bush, but probably you're not interested in the International
Alliance. I'm only interested in it really up to about the Second World War, and I've just got to stop there, because the subject would become so big otherwise.
Yes, I don't think there were seminars before. I don't know when the first seminar of the International Alliance of Women is. What is going to be the broad outline and object of your book?
Well, it's really to
write it?
It's really to see quite what the immediate effects of enfranchisement are, you see, because what the immediate effects of women...
Where her possessions were helpful, that is to say, she had in Buckingham Street, which is in the Adelphi, you know, she had a charming flat.
Are you saying about your friend and how she had this place in Buckingham Street?
Yes, she had a charming flat in Buckingham Street at the top of one of the old houses, almost overlooking the Embankment Gardens down there, you know. And she wasn't very long married, as things go. She had her silver and plates. The first luncheon that we gave to the British Commonwealth, we gave the first luncheons up in her rooms, above the flat, you see. And I had a sort of place down. I had a very nice office there, and I put a camp bed in, and I just slept there, lived there, you see. But she helped to organise the luncheons, just because it was something to do for women. It didn't really, wouldn't have mattered to her what it had been, I don't think. She wasn't concerned with suffrage or women's rights, though she was very insistent on her own. She didn't realise that her ability to get what she wanted in the protection of her property from anyone who was a little careless in handling it derived from the woman's movement, you see. You've got to be able to see the connection, but as she got less and less well, it was no use going on about that.
But
my choice was to put her into a nursing home, yes.
I was just going to ask you, what was the purpose of these luncheons then, Miss Collison?
Well, if you look at the list, perhaps there are some in here. I'm not sure whether this conference organisation mentions them. We have them still, you know, for 4 or 5 months in the year.
Is it to bring together representative women on a subject?
It's to bring a representative, man or woman, to give a good address on a particular aspect related to one of the members of the Commonwealth. There are now 32 members left, I think. How long there will be, we don't know. And generally, also to give a picture, say, of life. For example, we recently had one on Tonga. Dare say you've hardly ever heard of Tonga.
Well, Queen Salote came from Tonga.
Yes,
didn't she?
You remember the coronation?
Yes. Yes, I do, yes.
Remember her, that pouring wet day?
Yes, yes.
Not this Queen's coronation.
Yes, no, in 1953 I was thinking of, actually. What sort of people then were active in the League in England? I mean...
When?
Well, in the interwar period. I mean, were they English people?
Well, this is 1929. Let's have a look and see if they can answer it for you. Social functions. In fact, there were more English women, and now you see we're getting, if you come to one of the lunches, at least, I should have thought, 55 or 60% of them
Yes.
Were people with black faces.
I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, yes.
Were you a sort of centre for Commonwealth people coming to England?
We wanted to be that centre. But you see, the war had altered the character of the thing very much.
You mean the Second War or the First War?
No. The Second War has altered the character of the thing very much. Because during the gap, when a war comes, you see, things melt so much. They melt tremendously.
Because you're busy being a woman power organiser and things like that, you mean?
Well, I was in command of one of the woman power section, which kept the tide of labour moving in sufficiently small, skilled and unskilled occupations to make the big move possible.
Yes,
but
yes.
I was only a cog in the whole wheel, you see.
Yes, yes.
And the permanent civil servants
yes.
didn't like us temporaries, of course, but they had to accept it because we were very well placed.
Well, yes. But as organiser in the British Commonwealth League before the Second World War, you were the main person organising these annual meetings, really, were you?
Oh, now let me... Well, we had a committee of people, you see.
Yes.
Let's see now, what have we got here?
That was chaired by the President, I suppose,
yes,
was it?
Yes, chaired by the President.
But you tell the President what to do.
Well, not, you never had to tell Ashby much, but he didn't want to do the grubbing work, of course. Chairman's address, Mrs. Corbett Ashby, she's now Dame Margery.
Got to be boss or
no,
nobody.
Well, it's not only boss, it's so much else, you see, now. Now, for that reason, I have most carefully and patiently kept in the background.
While Mrs. Hemming was president, you mean?
Well, she still is, you see.
Yes, yes.
But I have kept, I sit on the executive committee and they ask my advice. I give a lecture for them occasionally, but not often now. But I'm talking now of some years, considerable time past.
You see,
now, of course, naturally, I'm getting old. But, you see, I conceive of the role that older women have to play is that in the first place they have laid a foundation. When you've laid a foundation, the next thing is to build. Now there are some things like walls which have to be built. There are other things like living shrubs, trees and human lives which grow. And there is a point in their growth where interference, the weight of the elderly, may be very, very dangerous.
So you have to bow out gracefully, so to speak.
Not as simple as that. Nothing like as simple as that. That's a very young view. What you have to do is to decide whether you will remain there and speak and think first, and then speak only at the moment when it is really needed.
Yes.
And for the rest, let it grow, even if it hurts you a little.
But
it's not a case of bowing out, it's a case of
being discreet, really. Yes, yes.
You see, as a mother watches a child, a good mother watches a child to grow. Well, so, if you're older, the most useful lesson you can learn as you get older. You'll find it out when you're around 50, probably, is how to let the others grow. And that's very important with women, you know. You want to be very careful. After all, why should your opinion of 20 years ago be so valuable?
Did you actually do a lot of travelling, Miss Collison?
Oh, any amount, yes.
I mean, you came to England in 1922. Did you stay in England all that time until the Second War, really? Or did you do a lot of travelling?
Really, I can't remember all I've done. Of course, I've forgotten one thing that I forgot to tell you, which has a relevance to the International Alliance of Women and partly a relevance to the Commonwealth. I did a lot of hard thinking. And I decided that what I would like to do, and this I began to do in 1927, I think it was, or 28, I thought what an important thing that needed doing was to set up some form of bureau, because I had to do something commercial, meaning getting money, a bureau which could carry the best of English thought, that possibly, which mixes so much, you know, what Latin and Roman and relationships and all that sort of thing, to Australia and to New Zealand. And the best way to do that, I considered at the time, was to get prominent people, and I should have to find the money, and go ahead, book the halls, which were always in great demand, and were very few when I first did this, and lay the plans and get the speaker to agree to come, and then build an organization which would almost automatically be able to pass great speakers forward. Because while some speakers... did you
is
want
the
something?
Bridge room?
I beg pardon? I hope you hadn't got the recording.
No, I hadn't actually, no. Now, you were talking about your bureau that you were creating.
Well, I was trying to create this bureau, you see, and I raised £4,000 on my own credit. I never had any money of my own, but I managed to get hold of it. And I got Dr. Maud Royden. Did you ever hear of her?
Oh, yes. Yes,
well,
I did, yeah.
She's a great friend of mine. Of course, she's dead now.
Yes.
I got her to come to Australia and New Zealand because she was going to America. And it's not so far a leap, you see.
No.
Well, I had to go ahead there for a year and get the interest of the women's groups, very often through the alliance groups, but there were other groups equally important, and attract them to the idea. Hire the halls, for example, a town hall in many places was booked months ahead. You had to be a year ahead to get it. For so many, you were taking an enormous chance, you see.
And you were planning her tour, really, in advance, were you?
Yes, but it's not like it is now. That's what I'm trying to make you understand. Wouldn't be much now. Because, for one thing, you could go to the package tour people and all that.
Yes.
There wasn't all that. There was nothing.
You had to do a lot for yourself, sort of thing.
There was nothing.
Yes.
Nothing whatever, don't you understand?
Mm.
Unless you had the money to put down, you couldn't get anything.
So did you actually travel with Maud Royden?
Well, we took her secretary as well. And then a great misfortune befell us. We met, in the first place, in New Zealand. It was most convenient. Her secretary, whom I have always considered was a bit of a hypochondriac, fell violently ill. And through the whole of the tour, I had to do the work of the secretary and the organizer, which is a grave mistake, because nobody ever understands that it's you who are supplying the money and the work.
Mm.
But however, that's my private trouble. Anyway, it was a great success. And then in 1929-1930, I mustn't mix my dates up, you see, my memory is going. I should have to check it.
It would be very difficult, I'm sure I'd find it very difficult to remember so far back, you know, the precise
details.
Well,
I've only just begun, because somebody asked me to write what memoirs I have, but my answer to that is thousands of people write their memoirs, and who buys them or reads them? Nobody that I know of.
But can you just describe what Maud Royden was like to work for? I mean,
I've known her too well.
Because she was a very influential woman, wasn't she?
Very, but very influential and very temperamental. And not very, very brilliant in many ways, able to make a very good figure. Of course, she was terribly lame, you know. You had to provide for her. She was twice as expensive as nearly anyone you could take anywhere.
Mm.
But we were great friends. I liked her very much.
But when you say she was temperamental, do you mean she went up and down in her moods?
Well, I don't see that I could say those things to you, even if I thought them.
Mm.
I don't think it's fair. She's dead.
Mm. But anyway, you knew her really quite well.
I knew her very well indeed, yes.
Because she's a person who obviously influenced a lot of people between the wars.
You see, every Sunday she had these services at the Guild House, which was bombed flat in the last war. And the Guild House used to be absolutely packed before she went to Australia. And then after the service, and she had in company with her, what was the name of that clergyman? I've forgotten his name.
Oh, I know who you mean. She eventually married him, didn't she?
Oh, no. Not that one.
Oh, well, then I don't know who you
Dearmer.
Mean. Oh, yes, Percy Dearmer, yes.
Percy Dearmer.
Yes.
And, no, she married someone quite different. At one of the reasons why she had so much influence, that is such fairly public knowledge, it's not important to me, not... UC was that they have been in love for years and years. Everybody knows that.
Well, she wrote a book about it, I think, didn't she?
Did she? I never read that book. I read lots of the books.
Yes.
But you see, mine is in some ways rather a hard mind, you see. Sentimentality doesn't appeal to me at all. Falling in real love does. That's something quite different.
But she was different in temperament, you feel, from yourself, was she?
Yes, her temperament was quite different. She couldn't always understand why it was necessary to do certain things and so on. But I am not here to criticise Maud Royden to you.
Can you tell me, though, why she was so influential? She had a certain magic about her, did she, in speaking?
Well, she had tremendous animal magnetism. It's plain enough, both men and women have it, and she has it.
You mean in looks or in voice?
No, in her voice, in her manner, in her bearing, and in her understanding of the problems of women, which very few people really understand, particularly the unmarried woman who perhaps falls in love with a married man. And she had, of course, profound religious faith, and she had means, you see. I don't think she ever drew more than 200-300 a year from the Guild House. And moreover, she was willing and accustomed to what was so very rare amongst religious speakers in those days. She hadn't that unctuous authority about her. She would answer questions. And therefore, every Sunday after the Guild House meeting, she held a question time. And she would discuss any questions that were asked as well as she could.
Just in front of a group, you mean?
No,
not in private.
The whole audience.
The whole audience,
yes. Guild House. Anyone could do it. There was an interval. And in any case, you know, the mass, so many people, many English people, are still a little feudal in their natures, you know. They understand the feudal atmosphere when it's well expressed. Probably you don't agree with me, but I think it's true.
No, you see, it rather puzzles me in a way. You seem to me so English in the way you speak. And yet you obviously regard yourself as an Australian.
No, I don't, not the least. I'm a woman of the world.
And you talk about English women as though you weren't an English woman yourself.
Not quite. But you see, I had a mother who was... so very highly educated, and yet had been courageous enough to marry a man who had no money, and they never had any money as long as they lived. And to adapt herself, as only a really able woman could do, it's much more than just being clever, to all the difficult circumstances of a life, which means bringing up 3 or 4 children on a grass string is not the word to express it.
What happened to her in the end?
She's dead, of course.
She died in Australia, did
yes,
she?
Yes, in Australia.
Yes, yes. She obviously influenced you a great deal.
Well, she depended on me a great deal, and unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which, I was a favourite child, partly because I could understand her a good deal. I often had to manage her so that she wouldn't be too unhappy, because the whole thing is personal and complicated. For a time, my father accepted a living in London, we were out there on the other side of the world. Just outside the main town, and...
In Tasmania, you mean?
Yes, I'm trying to remember exactly what the name of the place was, because we moved to Mount Gambier, South Australia, after that.
It was just outside Hobart, was
yes,
it?
Yes, in Newtown.
I see,
Newtown,
yes.
Just outside Hobart. And there, my eldest sister, who is now dead, contracted a scarlet fever. My mother and she were isolated for that reason. And then my sister was allowed to walk in a field. And the belief then was that people who had scarlet fever passed on the infection when their skin peeled. I don't know what the thing is now. It's probably quite different.
Yes.
And there were no antibiotics or anything of that sort, you see. So my mother used to burn the grass after she'd walked. One day she caught fire. And I was running down to the summer house. I used to take newspaper down to the summer house, then run away, and she would come pick it up. And I saw her struggling. She didn't even scream. I pulled off a thick, rough skirt I had on, wrapped it round her, and got her up to the house. Went tearing off for help, because we had no such thing as a telephone. And she bore all that for years. She was terribly ill, you see. Well, those things affect your life in a very deep and curious way, because I had to leave school, you see. I never could finish my education unless I finished it for myself.
Mm.
Well, those don't concern you, those.
But I think you said in your letter that you were doing a thesis. Well, wasn't that right at the London School of Economics?
I was supposed to be doing a thesis under Tawney.
Were you really?
Yes.
But what happened to that then, Miss Collins?
Well, I got sick of it.
Mm.
Left it. Lots of reasons, lots of things happened.
Because you found the women's movement more important?
Well, I found my personal life more important.
Mm.
And I got tired of the endless arguments and the little cliques and that sort of thing. And anyway, I hadn't enough money to have what I wanted to do published, you see.
Mm. Mm. Like, you were working under Tawney, were you?
Yes, I was working under Tawney, and he was very good to me indeed. And I think he was awfully disappointed when I gave everything up. I've got loads of these credentials and things, but you see, mine is a wild half-Irish spirit, as well as everything else.
And you like to be off, do you?
I do.
Yes.
I like to be off.
Mm.
And I go off.
Mm.
I've been fortunate in friendships. Now, how much are we telling each other, or am I telling you, about the British Commonwealth?
Well, you're telling me what sort of person created it, which is very important.
Well, Mrs. Rishbeath gave her money and time to help at the time, then she went back to Australia. I don't think she did very much there, but the name of the League spread. Well, now, you see, it's been changed from British Commonwealth League to Commonwealth Countries League, which is something different.
Mm.
Because as many of these people in Guyana and Ghana and so on objected to the idea that they were primarily British citizens. They wanted the idea that they were primarily a member of the Commonwealth in the right of their own country.
Mm.
That's how I see it. And now we get packed audiences for these luncheons that we have, which I've entirely neglected for years. I hardly ever go near now. At least I began to give them up when my friend got so ill.
But your friend's house was the only headquarters the League
no,
had
was,
at first.
There was
it?
Never the headquarters of the League.
I see, you just worked from wherever you
I
happened to.
I had an office, a proper...
Did you?
A very nice office, with an office for myself and a big room which Sarah Clegg supplied the money for.
Uh-huh. Where was that then, Miss Collison?
Street.
I see.
Looking onto the Adelphi.
Near your friend's house, was it? Or?
No. My friend's house had nothing to do with it, but it happened that her husband had reconstituted the top of the house and turned it into their flat after they were first married. Yes. But she had a cottage in the country. And he was one of Lloyd George's political secretaries. And when that came to an end, they often do abruptly those things, you know, they went down to live in the cottage for a while and let the flat to an English army man with a very fine reputation. And when, after a lot of complaint from other people there, when my friend went back to find her flat, ruined by this man, who had a whiskey bottle behind nearly every bottle shelf in the little library, and put coal under the bath so that the cat could run there, I'll ask you.
Mm.
Unspeakable condition. I helped her to clear that up for days. Now, what more can I tell you about the League, you see?
Well, you had an office quite near there then, did you?
Well, I've tried to explain to you. There was a house in Buckingham Street.
Mm.
And in down below there was a caretaker. And I had a small office and a big office there. And my friend, Mrs. Menken, and her husband had a flat on the very top floor.
I see, yes. And the whole thing really ran from there, did it?
Yes, as long as I was there. And then when I left, I gave it up because I saw there was no real future in it, you see. We got a girl, a woman called Todd Hunter. She was a curious creature. But anyway, she did her best. But then after all, during the war, it just about didn't exist much.
Yes.
There are two people you should ask about if you really want to do anything about the British Commonwealth. Married a man who was, I don't know whether he was suffering from a war wound or what it was. He's only just died fairly recently. She's moved away from where she was living. She's now living in Colchester, Essex.
Myra Sad Brown was her maiden name,
yes,
was it?
Yes, and she became Myra Stedman.
I see.
And if only you had, if I'd known that you'd realised, they were having, good God, yes, that reminds me, it's the annual general meeting of the Josephine Butler Society, and I shall have to be at the House of Commons at about, if I go, I don't know whether it's still raining.
Well, it's now 6:10, so...
Yes, well, I shall have to be there fairly soon.
Well,
they're
let me...
I'm dissociating myself from most of these organizations.